This mini course, okay, first of all, welcome. I'm very happy to give these lectures or to talk about this subject, which I'm basically just learning about myself because I think it's really nice and interesting. And I'm not an expert in it, so that's my big disclaimer right at the beginning. I've only been involved with it for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years. So you could ask, why am I doing it this at all if I'm not an expert? And the first reason is that Astrid Eichhorn suggested maybe I should give a mini course while I'm here. I'm spending the semester at Perimeter. And so I thought that maybe that's a good idea. What should I do it on? And this is the subject that I'm mostly excited about, that's most novel, that I thought people around here might be interested in and would know the least about. Because, well, I knew nothing about it. So that's really why I'm doing it. I should say that my involvement in it has been all with Sam Gralla, who is a postdoc at Maryland. And what I'll do is basically based on this long paper that we does that always do that? Is it? There must be helium in it. I guess maybe I better not use that one. What? You mean hold it down with a hockey stick? What?
You just need a counterweight.
Like this? Okay. Here's the long paper. 1401-6159. So let me just start with what's a relativist doing in a subject like this? Like, why would I ever have gotten involved in plasma physics? First of all, it's really going to turn out to be plasma without plasma. And Wheeler, I guess, coined those A without A phrases to express interesting, surprising emergence of some kind of subject from another subject. And here it's plasma physics. But the physics that motivates it is things like pulsars and astrophysical jets that come out from spinning black holes and also just spinning stars, which somehow involve conversion of rotational kinetic energy to electromagnetic energy flux and create spectacular fireworks in the universe, which are only partly understood so far. And I've been sort of aware of it from the side for many years, particularly mesmerized by pictures of these jets that come out of active galactic nuclei that are just extremely collimated, narrow pencil beams of, like, you know, ray guns, with no explanation of how exactly they're launched and why they're so collimated and how they stay together. It just seems amazing. So I was curious about that. The Blandford-Snyder mechanism I'd heard about, which is some way that using electromagnetic coupling, rotational energy can be extracted from a rotating black hole by a classical plasma process, but somehow using the Penrose process. And I was curious about how that works. And also, this idea of plasma without plasma, what it refers to is something called the force-free approximation. So maybe I should say, since that's in the title of the whole course, like, what is it? It's that the electromagnetic fields exert no force on the charges in the kind of coarse grain description. So there's no net force on, you know, locally, on charges. Locally, But that means that that energy and momentum are not transferred from the field to the charges, or at least it's negligible. The amount of energy and momentum that goes from the field to the charges is negligible. And the reason that's true in the settings we're going to talk about is because the field's really strong, and there just isn't that much mass in the charges to take up much energy or momentum. So to a good approximation, you can just neglect the four-force. But that means that the energy-momentum tensor of the field by itself is conserved. And so the field sort of defines an autonomous system. So the field evolves autonomously. But it's via some nonlinear equation that we'll get to today. Now, I'd heard about this and come across it in a few places, but it seems sort of impossible. How could you know, if charge generates field, and field makes charges move, and then you start with some initial condition and with charges somewhere with some velocities, and now you want to determine what's going to happen in the future without having any like equations of motion for the charge, no characterization of the charge. How much mass does it have? How is it distributed exactly? It just seemed impossible. And so I kept asking people, how can this possibly work? And nobody answered me for some reason, even though actually the answer is quite simple and it's in the literature. I just didn't come across it. So I just, you know, when I see a puzzle that I just can't understand, I can't stop asking, how does it work? So that's another reason why I got into the subject, fascination by the fact that you could eliminate the description of the charge dynamics and deal just with the fields. It reminded me this morning, I was thinking of the analogy with something that was called back in the 50s, maybe even earlier, the already unified theory. It's called Reinach's already unified theory. I don't know if you've heard of it. I'm too young also. But if you've read the literature, well, what unified refers to is unifying gravity and electromagnetism. So, you know, the unified field theory was this thing Einstein was working on for so long. And the idea here was to say, well, we already have a unified theory. We have Einstein's equation, G mu nu equals T mu nu of the electromagnetic field, let's say, 8 pi G. So if the only source of gravity were electromagnetic fields, we'd have some Einstein equation like this. And the idea is to say, well, let's just forget about Maxwell's equations. Don't even try to describe the electromagnetic field. This equation implies that the stress tensor of the electromagnetic field is conserved. So, and that's already telling us a lot about Maxwell's equations. And maybe if I just take any old metric and I write G mu nu, it won't have the form of a electromagnetic stress tensor. For example, it won't be traceless necessarily, which this has to be, but it also won't have the algebraic form. This thing is sort of quadratic in the field strength tensor that's an anti-symmetric tensor. I'll come to all this. This is just an introduction. So, but I guess Reinach figured out how to write conditions on G mu nu, or maybe on R mu nu, that implied that when you calculated it, it did have the form of an electromagnetic stress tensor. And then that was sort of already unified. So he could describe just with a metric, without electromagnetic fields, both gravity and electromagnetism. And then instead of the Einstein equation, which was true by definition, he had these other equations that implied that G mu nu sort of factorized in the form that the electromagnetic stress tensor does. It's kind of a crazy idea. You'd worry about things like, what about adding other types of matter and stuff? But it turns out actually that there's a fundamental flaw in the idea, which Penrose pointed out, which finally got into print when we, in 1993, there was a 60th birthday symposium for Dieter Brill and Charlie Misner at Maryland. And we asked the speakers to contribute to a Festschrift volume. And Penrose had told me that he had proved once that this theory, or maybe I read it somewhere that he had done it, this theory doesn't satisfy the condition of determinism. You can find initial data whose future evolution is not determined by this already unified scheme. And anyway, now that's published in one of those volumes, Penrose's argument. And similarly, for force-free electromagnetism, I figured it would be the same thing. How can you just eliminate the physics of the charges that tells where they're going to move when they find themselves in a particular field? And that depends on their mass, for example, how they accelerate. So how can you just remove the charge dynamics and still have a determined evolution? Well, we'll see how it works. It just happens. You can. I find it very surprising. So that's sort of roughly speaking the nature of this force-free approximation. And kind of why, what drew me into the subject, curiosity. It also turns out that the techniques and the mathematics underlying it are very similar to things that, you know, I've used for all other subjects I've worked on. Nice stuff with differential geometry and differential forms, relativistic concepts. When you encounter this field in the literature, it's normally been practiced by astrophysicists who just aren't really used to thinking like relativists and using the mathematical tools that we use. So you see electric and magnetic fields, you see a lot of intuition they had that I didn't share about how that works, so it was difficult to penetrate. So with Sam, we just kind of went back to square one and constructed the subject in our own language that I think probably I share with a lot of you, of which also led to insights and actually new solutions to the equations that are useful. So that's what I'll be talking about. I should say the relativistic viewpoint on this goes back originally to Brandon Carter. And the best place I found to read about it is in this, I think it was published in 79 maybe, Einstein's Centenary Survey. That's a volume with a bunch of articles by many people. It's edited by Hawking and Werner Israel. And Carter has a long article in there about the mechanical, thermodynamic, and electrodynamic properties of black holes. And for years, I read the part about thermodynamic and mechanical properties, and I never read the electrodynamic ones. It's at the end of a very long article. But at the end, there's this treatment that is very relativistic and is really the starting point for the language that I'll be developing. One other basic reference, only one other person really, I think, developed significantly this viewpoint, and that was Uchida in a series of papers in around 1998. I think there are about five papers. Well, that's what this is. But it's very fundamental. It didn't get adopted very much by other people in the astrophysical literature. I mean, it's certain. Well, let's get there. Yeah, I don't want to jump too far ahead of myself here. Okay, so what the course will do is basically go through this and some other things that are in here, most of the things, and a few other topics. And I wasn't sure how long it would take, so I'm just guessing four of these three-hour sessions. I think we should take at least one break each three-hour session, or maybe even two. just see what good points are to stop. So we'll see how that goes. I want to start with very basic things that are completely known to probably to most people, but maybe not to some students. I just want to start from the beginning so nobody is left out at the beginning. So I will just start by writing Maxwell's equations in standard 3+1 form, and then translate it to covariant notation. So we have electric and magnetic field vectors that are functions of position and time, and they satisfy these equations. So this is partial time derivative, and rho is the charge density, and J vector is the current density. So we should really think of these equations, which don't have any sources in them, as very different from these equations, which do have the sources in them. These equations tell us that the fields come from potentials. So since the divergence of B is zero, B can be written as the curl of something. And then if we plug that into the second equation, we get the time derivative of the curl of A, which is the same as the curl of the time derivative of A. This is the curl of E. So the difference between the time derivative of A and E has no curl. Has zero curl, so it must be the gradient of something. So that also tells us that E is equal to minus the time derivative of A plus the gradient of a scalar. So that's the usual vector potential and scalar potential that E and B come from, and these equations are just telling us that E and B can be derived from potentials in that way. Now, the connection to force, I guess I'll do that here. So the Lorentz force on a particle of charge Q, of course, is just Q times E plus V cross B. We're going to be talking about continuous distributions, the approximation of continuous distribution of charge and current. So instead of writing a force on a particle, we want to talk about force densities. So let's rewrite this as force divided by volume, so force per unit volume. And then we'll replace this by charge per unit volume, which is charge density. And then charge times velocity per unit volume is current density. So we have this continuum approximation for the three force density on charge and current. And I want to add to this an energy equation. So force is the rate of change of momentum, but we're going to put this in relativistic form in a second. So along with momentum is energy, and so the complementary equation tells us the rate of change of energy per unit volume as opposed to rate of change of momentum. So I'll write that this way, du, u being the energy, du dt divided by volume. And that's just going to be the work done on the charges per unit volume. And work on a particle with velocity v, the power input, the work per unit time, is the force dotted into the velocity. So I have to divide that by the volume to get the rate per unit volume. Here's the force. I have to dot that into the velocity, but the velocity was parallel to the current. So I just get E dot J. Rho times the velocity is the current, so this is equal to E dot J. Okay. And in the force-free approximation, what's going to happen, of course, is that these quantities on the right-hand side are going to be set to zero. Okay. Well, that's it for the non-relativistic language. Let's do this all relativistically now. Maybe actually I'll erase this. Well, don't need to yet. Okay, so how do we describe electromagnetic fields relativistically? We combine these two vectors into an antisymmetric tensor of space-time, the field strength tensor FAB, which is minus FBA. I want to introduce bracket notation, so it's equal to its own antisymmetric part. So when I put square brackets around indices, that means the antisymmetric part. So specifically here, that would be 1/2 FAB minus FBA. Just to be clear about notation. So this is the field strength tensor. And how do we get electric and magnetic fields out of it? Well, we have to specify who's observing them. So an observer has a four velocity, UA, that's some unit time-like vector. And if we contract U with the field strength, we get a four vector or a four covector, which is orthogonal to U, because if I contract with another U, I get zero because of the antisymmetry of FAB versus the symmetry of UA, UB. So this thing is called the electric field four vector, I guess. Let's just define it that way. So note that UB, EB equals zero. So because the component of E along U is zero, it has just three components. Those are to be thought of as three components of the electric field vector, as seen by the observer whose four velocity is UA. And similarly, then, we can define a magnetic field by doing the same thing, but with the dual of the field strength tensor, where the dual means, I guess I'll write it here, the dual of FAB is 1/2 epsilon AB CD FCD, where epsilon is the volume element. Epsilon ABCD is the, I'm putting it in quotes, so actually there are two, this is a totally antisymmetric tensor in four dimensions. If it's got four indices, that means that it's unique up to an overall scalar at each point. If we imposed it when we square it or contract it with another one with the inverse metric contracting all the indices, that we get a particular number, we determine it up to a sign, because squaring it, we lose track of the sign. And so there are two choices, which means that when we define the magnetic field, there's an ambiguity of sign. Just, it's sometimes useful to just keep that in mind. Okay, and I guess I should say that epsilon, the convention that I'll use is that epsilon ABCD, epsilon A, B, C, D is, what is it? It's minus 4 factorial. I think. Eric will correct me if I'm wrong. It's a minus sign because one of these contractions is a time-like one and the other ones are space-like. And it's 4 factorial because there are 4 factorial permutations of 4 indices. And yeah, that's right. Anyway, I think this is a pretty standard definition of normalization for it. Oh, and I should say that there's a summary of dualization properties and differential forms, basic math about differential forms in Appendix A of our paper. This paper here. Okay, so is that just defining? Right, so what we want to do now that we've figured out how to define electric and magnetic field, translate these equations into equations for F. So let's start with the source-free ones first. They're just that the totally anti-symmetric derivative of F is 0. So I like to call this Faraday's law, even though traditional nomenclature is that only this equation is Faraday's law, and the absence of a magnetic monopoles equation, this one, is just some other equation, but clearly they fit together in one thing, and Faraday deserves more honor than he gets, so let's call it Faraday's law. Or the covariant Faraday's law. And then the other equations packaged together into, and this sign I never know, so BFAB is the four current density. So J is the four current density. Its time component in a given frame is the charge density, and its space components are the three current density. There's one free four-vector index, so this is four equations corresponding to the four equations in this box, 1 plus 3. And this is also four equations because being that these indices are totally anti-symmetrized, I can characterize what indices I've chosen by saying which one I didn't choose. Which value of 0, 1, 2, or 3. So I have four choices of the one that doesn't appear. So there are four equations. Alternatively, I guess I could just use the duality here and rewrite this equation as the fact that the divergence of the dual of F is 0. But as you'll see, it's sort of nicer to write it this way, or even another way. Okay, and what about the potentials? Well, if this is a sort of covariant curl. If the curl of F is 0, then F can be written as the curl of something else. So this actually implies that FBC is the anti-symmetric derivative of a vector potential A. I'll multiply by 2 just to get rid of this 1 half here by standard conventions. And so A is the 4 vector potential. And I should say that I'm using here, I will be consistent about units, and apparently they're called Heaviside, Lorentz, units. Meaning that there's no 4 pi, no epsilons, knots, and mu knots, and things like that there. Okay. Now, what about the... I guess I'll say that. The 4 force, so we had this 3 force density and the rate of change of the energy density. These come together into the 4 force density, which is just, in fact, maybe I should introduce it by the conservation law. Conservation of energy momentum states that divergence of the electromagnetic stress tensor, which I'll write down in a second, plus, and here I really don't know what sign to use, so I'll just pick one randomly. Okay, where the electromagnetic stress tensor is FAC, FBC, minus a quarter, FCD, FCD, GAB. So it's not just that we're making everything nice and special relativistic. This is actually also consistent with general relativity. In that context, this grad symbol has to represent, actually right here, it doesn't matter. It's any torsion-free derivative operator because the anti-symmetrization makes it independent of the connection. But here, this construction definitely depends on how this on the connection here, and so we're using the metric compatible. If we use the metric compatible derivative operator, then this is locally, in a local inertial frame, agrees exactly with the special relativistic version, and so it's how we generalize Maxwell's equations to curved spacetime. Okay. Then, the idea of force-free here would be expressed by saying that this 4 force density would be vanishing or would be negligible, which would be equivalent to saying that the electromagnetic stress tensor by itself is conserved. And that's going to turn out to be one of our two basic field equations. You can either think of this vanishing as the field equation or this vanishing as the field equation. Because I should say this, this is true as an identity. If you define the electromagnetic stress tensor this way, and you take into account the covariant Faraday law, then this is just an identity. So it's a consequence of Maxwell's equations. And something else we'll use a lot is the two invariants that we can form from F. So out of F, we can make electric and magnetic fields, and they depend on what observer is looking at them. That is, they depend on U. But we can also form two scalars that don't depend on any choice of U. And those are FAB, FAB, and FAB dual of FAB. And what those work out to be in terms of the electric and magnetic fields of a given observer are 1/2 b squared minus e squared. And I think I got the coefficients right, 4 e dot b. This is very important thing to keep in mind. So whatever observer is going to change what they see for E or B, but they'll always get the same value for this combination and this combination. Okay, yeah, that's going to be... Yes.
I was late, so you might have said this before. When you consider the first free approximation, what is small with respect to what? FAB, JB is small with respect to what?
I don't have a really nice sharp way to say this. The way I said it before, and I think the best way I can at this point, is that the energy and momentum in the charges is small compared to the energy and momentum in the fields. So small that even though, of course, there is some energy and momentum being transferred from the field to the charges or vice versa, it's negligible. So you can get away. It's not negligible from the point of view of the charges. They feel like they're getting kicked around. But from the point of view of the field, you can just neglect that transfer. And that's where this whole approximation starts out. I feel a little uncomfortable, probably in the same way you do, about the lack of sharpness in that statement. But that's the best I can do for now.
Yeah, I mean, when you say it like this, I think it makes more sense than that. So the way you approach it first is to say that, well, the fields are not exerting forces on the charges.
Right.
And that's a little bit harder to understand than the notion that what is the energy transfer is negligible with respect to the field.
Right.
But not so much with respect to the charges.
Right. It's just from the field's viewpoint. I guess the kind of thing you might worry about is, it might be negligible rate of transfer at a given time, but let's say, could it accumulate? So even if at each instant it's negligible, maybe the solution sort of evolved to the point where you can't neglect it anymore. Except for once you've, it turns out, as you'll see, there's really a self-consistent, self-contained theory where you just set this strictly to zero. And then the fields evolve in a way consistent with that, deterministically. So you can't sort of, but there is a problem that'll come to. Okay, that's enough said about that for the moment. I should actually point out here that this invariant classifies all fields into three types, depending on the sign of this invariant. So if it's positive, then B squared is greater than E squared, and that's true in all frames then. And that's called magnetic or magnetically dominated. So let's say if F squared, we'll just call this F squared, is positive, that's magnetically dominated. And of course, if it's less than zero, it's electrically dominated. And then if it's equal to zero, that's some other case, which I don't actually know a name for unless it's also true that this invariant vanishes, in which case it's called a null field. So if this and F AB, dual of FAB, equals zero, it's called null. Okay, so these are just basic. Now, because this has been all math so far, almost, I want to start talking about a little bit of physics before I get to full force free. Something more simple than force free. Do I need this? I do need that. So I think I will use this. So let's consider how to describe perfect conductors. So in terms of electric field and three current density, we have this transport sort of relation that the three current density in a resistive medium is in an ohmic medium is given by the conductivity times the electric field. Conductivity. This is for, quote, ohmic medium. So if we have something that's a perfect conductor that has infinite conductivity, the charges, there's plenty of charge and they're completely mobile, then this would be infinite, which means this would be infinite unless E is zero. So infinite conductivity or zero resistance implies, but finite current implies that the electric field vanishes. So sigma equals infinity implies E equals zero. But, of course, E depends on the observer. So this statement can only be true in one reference frame. Which frame is it? It's the frame of the medium in which Ohm's law would hold somehow. So that it's clear what it means if you have a piece of metal and it's got a lattice structure and the ions, you know, are at rest in some frame, and it's that reference frame in which E should be zero. So what this really corresponds to is that in the frame of the conductor, well, let's say medium, UAFAB is zero. Something that's a bit slippery, it turns out, in the force-free approximation is there isn't any well-defined U, but it turns out to be, that's okay, because the condition will be invariant under the ambiguity of U's. But for the case of a piece of metal, it's certainly, another nice example would be consider a conducting fluid. So a fluid that has a well-defined four velocity at each point, it might be like an ionic plasma. So it has free charge, electrons and ions. The ions are much more massive and presumably have some average rest frame that they define at each location in the plasma. So it has a well-defined, or it may have a well-defined, let's say, if it has, how about that? A well-defined, that's much better, U fluid. Then if it's a perfectly conducting fluid, we have this condition that I just wrote. A fluid, FAB equals zero. And that goes by the name of perfect MHD. Being magnetohydrodynamics.
You mean perfect or ideal?
Ideal, I guess. What's the difference?
I know it would ideal.
Okay. I'll call it ideal. Yeah, I do think I've not seen perfect very much, if ever. Magnetohydrodynamics. Okay, so just as an example to keep in mind that we'll definitely talk about. Okay, so these field tensors that have the property that they admit a four vector such that when you contract it with them you get zero play a very special role in this whole subject. That four vector might be the four velocity of a medium, But it turns out it's even more general than that. In the case of force-free, it'll actually be the four-current density. But let's just say any four-vector, of all the antisymmetric rank 2 tensors you can think of, consider just those ones that sort of have a zero eigenvector. They're called degenerate, and we need to describe them algebraically because they're basically the bread and butter of this whole subject, degenerate fields. So, yeah, so let's look into the structure of degenerate fields.
Sorry, so
yes.
This force-free condition, it's always frame-dependent, like this example? Because if this is zero in this frame, it isn't necessarily the frame of the medium. It isn't zero in other frames.
It's not going to be zero in all other frames, but there are some other frames it will be zero in.
Yeah.
And I'm actually just about to explain like what frames they are. It's really a one-parameter family of frames.
OK, so it's always a frame-dependent
statement. Yeah.
This force-free condition.
Well, wait a second.
There's no other covariant.
The condition is a covariant statement. I mean, this is a four-vector. I guess the statement that's frame-dependent is that the electric field vanishes. If you actually, I might as well anticipate it. So let's say electric field vanishes, but there is a non-zero magnetic field. Then if you boost in the direction of the magnetic field, so go into a frame moving in the direction of the magnetic field, then the electric field will still be zero. But if you boost in any other direction, it won't still be zero. So there's a one-parameter family of such frames. So let's consider the general algebraic problem of degenerate fields. So suppose there exists a vector W such that W contracted with F is zero. Then F is called degenerate. FAB is called and let's see what it implies about F. It means F has a very simple form. So we can say that this looks like it's complicating things, but it actually will lead to a very good result in a second. So let's take two Fs and totally anti-symmetrize on all four indices. If this is zero, then of course this is zero because this A will either contract with one of the indices on this F or that one. So then we have 0 is equal to that. But all totally anti-symmetric four-index tensors in four dimensions are proportional to the volume element. So this implies that WA contracted with the volume element contracted with some function. So this thing is equal to, I need some name for it. I don't know, beta times epsilon ABCD. Because with it beta being some function. But now epsilon is not degenerate. There's no vector you can contract epsilon with and get zero. So if this is zero, it must imply that it can only be that beta is zero. So this implies that beta is zero. Because epsilon is not degenerate, but beta being zero just implies that this totally anti-symmetric product is zero. And that's actually equivalent to saying that F contracted with its dual is zero because we could just contract this with an epsilon. So this is the same as saying FAB, dual of FAB is zero. which is the same as saying that E dot B is zero. So for any field that has some vector which satisfies this, E dot B is zero. Conversely, if there's any reference frame in which the electric field vanishes, well, then this is zero, but this is an invariant, so that means that there exists a vector that contracted with F gives zero. Or if there's any frame in which the magnetic field vanishes, the same thing is true. So somehow equivalent, degeneracy is equivalent almost, but not quite, to there existing special frames in which either E or B is zero. There is the null case, however, where neither E or B is zero, but they're orthogonal, and that's also a case of this. Now I want to claim that if this is true, actually I might as well write it right here, this implies that F can be factorized. It's actually, again, if and only if FAB is the skew product of two one-forms, two covectors. So it's alpha A, beta B minus beta A, alpha B. For some alpha and beta. So in the case of degenerate fields, we can trade F for a pair of covectors. Yes, there is a very quick way to see it. I'll show you right now. Maybe I don't need this anymore. So let's do a proof of that. So if F is not zero, there must be a pair of vectors that you can contract it with and get non-zero. So if F is not equal to zero, we can choose, let's say, x and y such that xa, yb, fab is not zero. But then just contract x and y with this equation. Is that what I want to do? Yeah. So then this implies that XAYB, FAB, FCD is zero. Not because this by itself is zero. So it's still zero if I contract it with an X and Y. But if I expand out this anti-symmetrizer, I'll get terms where the A and the B are both on this F, and they will give me X, A, Y, B, F, A, B times F, C, D. I'm not sure how many of them there are. Is it two or four? Anyway, it doesn't matter. And then I'll have terms where A and B are on the second one, but they give me the same thing. And I'll have terms where A is on one of the Fs and B is on the other. And those will give me something like, so there's some number here, XAFAC times YBFBD. But I mean, the thing I'm starting with is anti-symmetric in C and D, so I'm also going to get the same thing with C and D reversed. Yes?
So it's quite similar to the simplicity conversion.
To what?
To the so-called simplicity conversion.
Exactly, yeah. I'll write it, in fact, that way in a moment.
Oh, and then there's the first condition before now, the linear simplicity condition, which is that there exists a vector which is also near to F.
Sorry, the you mean this?
Yeah, this before now, the linear simplicity condition.
Oh. You mean the existence of such a W is the linear simplicity condition?
Yeah. And
oh.
F times, I think F star F is, would be the quadratic simplicity condition.
Yeah.
And it always means that you can write the
two forms. As a wedge product of two one forms? Yeah. I'll actually.
I think there could be some easy geometric element for a simple vector.
I should say I'm going to translate momentarily all of this into the language of forms, and then I'll also comment on that again. So I think this, this is the only type of terms you can get. The coefficients are probably either 2 or 4, I'm not sure. But anyway, this being 0 and this being non-zero by assumption, I can divide through by that, so I get that F itself is just the skew product of two one forms. So I can identify, let's say, alpha with this one divided by XY contracted with F. So that's a very direct computational proof of it.
Electrodynamics, you could add this as a topological, the FAB star FAB as a topological term.
Yes.
But then what you do in that in Clemanski is to add it as a constraint. And so you would actually add this as a constraint.
Right.
And so maybe that gives you.
You can also do that here. Add it as a constraint to Maxwell theory, and you get force-free electromagnetism. I'll explain it to you.
It's similar to what one does in Klimansky.
Yeah, this is part of the answer to what's a relativist like you doing in a field like this.
Sorry.
There's a lot of very nice stuff like that. I'll get to. Okay, so. So I want to relate the properties of alpha and beta to this classification of degenerate fields, of classification of fields into magnetically, electrically dominated or null. In this case, because we're assuming from the beginning it's degenerate, and therefore, as I pointed out here, so E dot B is zero or FF dual is zero. So this invariant is zero. So if also this invariant is zero, that's the case I said is called null. In that case, F will be a null two form. So let's just see how that works out. And to do that, it's simplest to choose. We can always shift beta by some part proportional to alpha without changing this, because the part proportional to alpha will cancel out. So that means that we can actually choose alpha and beta to be orthogonal without loss of generality. Maybe I'll erase this proof. So I want to claim we can choose alpha and beta orthogonal without loss of generality, because let's say I shift alpha by some thing proportional to beta, or maybe I should have said beta proportional to alpha, it doesn't matter, okay. And then I want this to be orthogonal to beta, So I'll just write that as dot. This is equal to alpha dot beta, which I guess we're assuming is not zero to begin with, otherwise we would already have them orthogonal, plus lambda beta dot beta. So I can always solve for lambda unless beta dot beta is zero. That's a good point. And what happens if beta dot beta is zero?
And I think you can change beta.
Pardon?
And you can change beta.
Thank you. well, unless alpha dot alpha is zero. They could both be null. No, actually I'm not, because they could be... No, they're definitely not null. Hold on a second. No, I actually think that's a restrict. I have to generalize the proof to deal with that case. It's not the null case, because you can always write the skew product of, let's say, a time, strictly pick a particular reference frame in a two-dimensional Minkowski space and take the purely time-like vector and the purely space-like vector orthogonal to it. The skew product of those two is basically going to be proportional to the skew product of any two vectors in that plane, including two null vectors. So I certainly could take the two null vector case and it wouldn't be a null bivector. But then if I tried to arrange for them to be orthogonal by shifting one of them with respect to the other, it wouldn't work. So actually it shows us that something in our paper is incomplete. But I actually just gave the resolution to that, because I could always take any pair of vectors in the plane spanned by alpha and beta. I can find some vector in that plane whose norm is not zero and just do it with that one. So let me just not offer this as a total proof, but just say that I can, without loss of generality, choose them orthogonal to each other. If I do, then let's calculate this invariant. FAB, FAB will just be alpha A, beta B, minus beta A, alpha B, contracted with the other thing. And the terms where alpha contracts with beta, I get zero by assumption that they're orthogonal. So I just get alpha squared beta squared plus alpha squared beta squared. So I get twice alpha squared beta squared. This tells me that if this is positive, so if it's magnetically dominated, then either both of alpha squared and beta squared are positive or they're both negative. But they can't both be negative, because that would be two orthogonal time-like, oh, I should say what signature I'm using. So let's say we're using a minus plus 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 signature. So there's one dimension of vectors whose square is negative, or covectors, and three dimensions that are positive. So alpha and beta being orthogonal can't both have negative squares, because there's only one time-like direction. So to be magnetically dominated, they must both be space-like. So so if F squared is greater than zero, then both alpha and beta are space-like. That's the magnetic case. If it's negative, then one is space-like and one is time-like. And if it's zero, then one of them has to be zero, but they're orthogonal to each other. So the second one has to be orthogonal to a null vector, So it has to be a space-like vector in the null plane orthogonal to the null vector. So this is one is null and one is space-like. I need that. This all erase. That's okay. I'll put this up here. Okay. So rather than focusing on these covectors, I want to focus on the vectors that annihilate F, this linear simplicity vector. So let's define the kernel of F to be the set of vectors W such that W contracted with F is 0. So I want to learn what's the nature of that kernel in the three different cases that we just talked about in the degenerate case. What's the dimension of it, et cetera. So clearly, because F is the wedge product of these two, in order for W to give 0, well, let's just write it out. So this means that W alpha beta minus W beta alpha equals 0. But beta and alpha are independent vectors. If they weren't, if they were parallel, F would just be 0. So as long as F is not 0, the only way this can vanish is if both of these coefficients are 0. But that means that W is in the kernel of alpha and is in the kernel of beta. So that means this is equal to the kernel of alpha intersect the kernel of beta. Now, alpha is a covector. The condition that this be 0 is one condition on four components of W, so that defines a three-dimensional space in four dimensions. The kernel of alpha is three-dimensional. The kernel of beta is three-dimensional. And the intersection of two three-dimensional subspaces in four dimensions is two-dimensional. So this is two-dimensional. So the kernel of F is two-dimensional. At each point, it's some plane. That plane is the plane that's orthogonal to alpha and beta. And we just said that in the magnetic case, alpha and beta are both space-like, but that means the plane orthogonal to them has one time-like direction and one space-like, so it's time-like. So this case, the kernel of F is time-like. This is all going to be completely obvious in a minute when I say it in terms of electric and magnetic fields, I think, but in the case where it's electrically dominated, the plane orthogonal to this time-like plane has to be space-like. So the kernel of F is space-like. And in the null case, it has to be orthogonal to a null plane. And that's maybe less familiar, but it has to be another null plane. It has to share the same null direction. Let me explain this, because that's always confusing to people who haven't ever played around with null planes before. So here I'm going to say the kernel of F is null. Let me explain the null case explicitly with an example. Example of null case. So let's take a basis of four vectors or covectors of vectors, let's say TA, XA, YA, ZA in a given tangent space or in Minkowski space. So this is an orthonormal basis. Then I can make a null vector, of course, by doing something like TA plus ZA. And I can ask, what is the space orthogonal to this, or what are the vectors orthogonal to this null vector? Well, X is orthogonal to both T and Z, so it's orthogonal, and so is Y. And this is orthogonal to itself, so it's this. It's the space spanned by x, y, and this null vector itself. And if this happened to be a null field, then it might have to be something like, so a null field, a null FAB, could correspond to TA plus ZB, let's say x, sorry, plus ZA, XB, minus XA TB plus ZB. So there's an example of something that's degenerate like that. And it's null. And it's formed of skew product of a null vector and some space-like vector orthogonal to that null vector. And if I now ask, what's the kernel of this? Well, it'll include that null vector itself with the index raised. And now it won't include x with its index raised because that doesn't give 0 when you contract it with f. It has to be the other vector orthogonal to t, namely y. So it could be this and ya. Or the span of that. So let me just pause for a second and make sure it's clear what I'm saying there. I have this image in my head of how it works when you take the orthogonal. A null bivector has a null direction and some space-like direction orthogonal to it. And then I want to take the orthogonal plane in four dimensions. I have to keep the same null direction, but I rotate the space-like direction orthogonal to it, to another space-like direction. That's the relation between. So they intersect each other, which is different than the case of time-like or space-like planes. It's just weird. OK. So this is probably almost a good time to take a break. Let me just see. Oh, you know, I didn't say something very basic. We inferred here that if F is degenerate in this sense, which is equivalent to saying FF dual is 0 or this wedge product is 0, then F is written, this can be written as the antisymmetric product of alpha and beta. But conversely, of course, if you have an F of this form, then automatically FF totally antisymmetrized is 0 because you end up antisymmetrizing alpha with itself or beta with itself. So it's really equivalent. Saying that F is degenerate is equivalent to saying it can be written in this decomposed form. All right. Are there any questions? Some puzzlement, I sort of get the feeling.
Did you say alpha and beta form a surface in the space?
I spoke as surface, but since they're actually covectors, that's not the right language. Oh, in the space-time?
Yeah.
Or in a tangent space?
In the space-time.
Ah, I'm getting to that. I didn't. Uh-oh. If I said it, I shouldn't have yet, but I will say that the kernels form surfaces. That's crucial. But I think I didn't say it yet. So That's exactly, I think, the next topic. But I think maybe this is a good time to take a break. Then I'll start on the differential forms language for this and the frozen flux theorem and helicity. Helicity is not in our paper, actually, but it's a super interesting topic. And then I'll get back to the question you asked. So,
yeah. Those cases over there. So I guess for astrophysical applications, the magnetically dominated regime is probably the most relevant.
Thank you for mentioning that. Well, it's the one that's most relevant if we want to use the force-free approximation. It's not the one that's most relevant, like in general, you might have electrically dominated fields. In fact, you need them to accelerate particles.
Right.
But it's very important that force-free, in fact, it'll turn out that the whole force-free scheme only makes sense, apparently. I mean, it mathematically, you can write it down, but it only makes sense as a deterministic, like well-posed initial value problem in the magnetically dominated case. But then, and I think I might as well anticipate something fundamental about it also, there's no guarantee that if you start in the magnetically dominated case, that the evolution of the force-free equations will keep you in that case. In fact, generically, you will run out of that case. And you'll hit, and that's a very interesting thing. What's the physics that's happening when you get to the edge of magnetic domination? And I'll definitely talk about that later in the course. And I think it's one of the areas where I see a huge gap in the literature of understanding the lead up to that. You know, like in general relativity, the nature of the generic singularity is a fundamental question, right? In classical general relativity. How do singularities form? Can we classify the types? You know, can we classify when they're going to form? Singularity theorems, all that stuff. There should be the same thing in force-free electrodynamics. Can we characterize when we're going to run off the edge of magnetic domination? And it has real physical implications, but I haven't seen a single theorem or statement or classification or anything like that in this field. And I think it's ripe for it. And it's got to be, you know, an order of magnitude at least easier than the general relativity question. So the reason it hasn't been done, I don't know. Do you have any comment, Louise? Right, so that's one reason why I'm giving this course, because probably, hopefully out of this will come a few people interested in pushing it forward in ways it hasn't been pushed before.
So the real question I had is whether the null case, is there any physics there? I mean, is there, you know, applications or?
Yes, I mean, maybe. That's actually another thing I'll talk about. To just give you a little teaser, Sam and I are now playing with the idea that the null case can describe jets. The problem is it can't be exactly the null case because it's probably being on the edge of deterministic, it's mathematically maybe ill-posed for, say, perturbations or something around it. So it might be that it has to be the null case plus epsilon, but that might be enough to make it perfectly fine. So let's say as a limiting case, the null case is crucial. In fact, let me give one other simple example. It seems like generically, if you have a spinning pulsar and you look at the far field, it sort of goes to the null case asymptotically. So there's something about, it's kind of a limiting case that's relevant, but probably not a volume filling case. Okay, so let's, how much of a break should we start at 2:30? Or should we take a longer break than that? That's an 8-minute break, according to my watch. What? It'll become 15 anyway? All right, let's start at 2:45, take a real break.